Well, most of us have spent time at a local soup kitchen or sorted cans for harvesters, but some people take an entirely different approach to donating their time. Today, we're talking about extreme volunteering, situations where you're giving weeks or even years of your life to help others and sometimes getting into some pretty hairy situations. With us today are Joe Flake. He's a volunteer firefighter for Paola, Kansas, and a paid firefighter in the Overland Park Fire Department. Joe, nice to have you.
Thanks a lot.
Welcome to
Good
today.
To be here.
Kirsty Morgan is a former Peace Corps volunteer in Kazakhstan and a current president of a Kansas City returned Peace Corps volunteer group. And Kirsty, nice to have you too. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Joe, how did you decide you wanted to become a volunteer firefighter?
You know, it's actually been about 25 years ago. I had a friend who was on the volunteer department, and he just asked me one day, he says, you know, you ever thought about getting on the department? And really had not even thought about that.
You weren't getting enough with your full-time job with the Overland Park Fire Department?
At that time, I wasn't on the department yet. So he just asked me if I'd ever considered that, had not, and I went and talked to the chief, and one thing kind of led to another.
What drew you into it? What did you like about the idea of doing it?
Oh, you know, I think it's kind of exciting. It's kind of fun. Of course, there's always the community service side of it. It felt good to be able to do that. And it was a good group of guys, and just a way that we could give back to the community, and I really enjoyed it.
But again, this is different than most volunteer jobs, as I mentioned in the opening. I mean, some folks sort cans at harvesters. This is a job where you could get hurt. What about that?
I think that's probably true, and you know, we do a lot of training and we do a lot of prep to make sure that doesn't happen. Certainly,
yeah.
That's not something that we're interested in doing. But you know, it's a way for us to give back that a lot of people really could not do. It's a pretty elite group of people that are able to do that.
And this is a fairly intense commitment to how so?
It really is. You know, it depends on how the department is set up. But basically in our department, you know, you need to be ready to go 24/7. So, you know, we can get out of bed in the middle of the night. We can leave dinner. You can leave your son's baseball game or football game. So you pretty much got to be ready to go most of the time anyway, unless you've kind of got a little bit different arrangement.
And you've got a monitor, I'm sure, with you all the time, right?
I do. I wear a pager.
Everybody
wears a pager. Uh-huh. And, you know, you got to make sure you got your gear with you or you're going to go to the station to respond. You pretty much whenever the pager goes off, you need to be ready to go.
And you might have to travel a ways, too, I'm gathering, in a rural community to get where you have to go.
Yeah, you really do. We typically respond to the station. We run both the city of Paola, and then we run an area outside of Paola in the county as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we may have to go a ways to get onto a rural fire.
So if dinner goes cold, that's just the price you pay.
It's just part of the deal. I've gone to work tired the next morning many times.
That's Joe Flake. He's a volunteer firefighter for Paola, Kansas. Let me turn to Kirsty Morgan now. Speaking about time commitment, Kirsty, imagine signing up to be a full-time volunteer for 2 years on the other side of the world. Pretty big step.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Why'd you want to do it?
Oh, you know, I think I'd always wanted to join the Peace Corps. When I was in high school, I was always interested in international cultures. I enjoyed volunteering. I volunteered with my church. When I was in college, I led the alternative volunteer spring break
yeah.
activities. And I had studied international development as well in college. That was my major.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd always had an interest in going overseas and helping out.
Well, that's one kind of volunteering, what you're doing here at home. But going overseas is a completely different kettle of fish. Why'd you want to take that leap?
You know, I think I'd always just wanted to travel the world, and I was interested in other cultures.
Yeah, sure.
And I think when you're younger, you don't really know what you're getting into, and you think you want to help build bridges between countries. You have a lot of idealism, and you don't really think about the dangers. You just think, this is an exciting opportunity. I get to help people. I get to see the world. That's what motivates you.
Had you ever heard of a place called Kazakhstan before you left?
No, not really. I know at the time when I was in college, it was the early 90s, and we heard about the breakup of the Soviet Union. So Kazakhstan was one of the former Soviet republics. So I'd heard about it a little bit, but I really didn't know that much about it.
But why not, eh? It begins with a K. Sounds interesting. Let's go.
K. My first name starts with a K.
There you go.
Kazakhstan.
Some serendipity there. Yeah.
Sure. Sounded good.
And just for our listeners, get it. Where is that country?
So Kazakhstan is the ninth largest country in the world.
Wow.
Picture two Alaskas. It's about the size of it. It is south of Russia, and it's to the west of China, and it's north of the stans, so Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and the rest of them.
You know, most people, I think, Kirsty, when they think about the Peace Corps, they think about Africa. And villages in Africa. And here you are again doing something very different than that. Did you have that impression too? And what impression should people have of the Peace Corps and the work that gets done there?
Yeah, so I think that's a very common impression that you're going to live in a mud hut, you're going to serve in Africa. It's going to be this picture of poverty where people are starving. And so it was a really different idea to go to a place that was formerly developed, but their development was crumbling. So we kind of consider it second world rather than third world.
And they speak Russian there and Kazakh there, but you just had some fundamental Russian skills when you went over there. How did you get by, and how difficult was that?
It was difficult.
Boy,
definitely.
Especially at first, right?
Yes. I had a little bit of Russian in college. But the Peace Corps does train you. That's one of the components that they train you in before they send you off to your site.
But you still didn't know the language, though.
Well, we had about 2.5 months of training. So you get the fundamentals. You know how to go to the market. You can buy food. You know how to communicate basic information. You could do toasts in Russian. That's really important in Kazakh. But as far as really communicating high-level ideas, no, I didn't have that skill.
How long did it take you to get comfortable with the language and get up to speed and be able to communicate a little bit?
Well, I would say for me, I'm not a natural, easy learner of languages. So it took me at least a year to get more comfortable. And then I felt like I could be more understood and I could communicate a little bit better. But it did take a while.
That's a long time.
It is. It's true.
How lonely was it?
Oh, extremely lonely.
Really?
Well, I was in a place that is southern Siberia. So I was in the very northern part of this huge country. And about 2 days by train away from the Peace Corps office in Almaty, which is the former capital and the biggest city in Kazakhstan. So I was in this very isolated town. It was a large town, but it was more like the mindset of a large village. So it was about 100,000 people, but you're kind of isolated up there. It's very cold. It gets cold really quickly. Even this time of year, it might even snow.
Well, I'm trying to wait for a moment here where you're selling me on the idea of wanting to go over there. I haven't heard it yet quite, Kirsty.
Yeah, we're going to get there. Why you want to join the Peace Corps.
So what you're saying is there's not a McDonald's down the road or an English-speaking movie theater just across town. It wasn't that kind of deal.
No, when I served there, it was not very westernized at all. There was no McDonald's anywhere.
And do people assume you were an expert in teaching? I mean, you didn't have any teaching experience either. How did you make that work for you?
Yeah, so I had Peace Corps training. They train you before they send you off to the site, so about 2.5 months of training. And you're supported by Peace Corps, but once you're at your site, you pretty much have to rely on your training and then, keep yourself up to date with information.
And was teaching difficult for you, or did it come fairly easily?
No, I think it was not easy for me. I definitely had to work hard on it. And I did work hard to try to craft lessons. But really, I think the first year of any teacher, whether they're in the U.S. or overseas, is always difficult. And once you have that first year down, then you can relax and feel like, okay, I've learned what works. I've tried out different lesson plans. I've seen different techniques that maybe I'll throw some out and maybe use others in my second year of teaching.
We're visiting with Kirsty Morgan, a former Peace Corps volunteer, about her work in Kazakhstan. Did people assume you were an expert, you were a great teacher just because you were American, that you just walk in the door and you'd know what to do?
I think so. I think overseas they have a feeling that if you're American, you're an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And of course I wasn't, but I tried my best to implement the training that I learned in Peace Corps and introduce new techniques and do what I was there for, which is to encourage conversational English speaking. I was not an expert. There were some really professional teachers that I worked with at this pedagogical college that I worked at.
Mm-hmm.
And they had really good techniques in Russian, and they could teach well in their own native language. But I was there to kind of finesse their English speaking and kind of introduce some new methodology.
So you could speak with them in English, or at least somewhat, would I gather?
Right, because I was working in the English department. So I would speak with the teachers of English, and mm-hmm. at least that was a little bit easier communication than when I tried to speak Russian with some of the other teachers.
How were you able to keep in touch with home? I mean, this is before the internet, I'm gathering, and
it was on when the internet just started to be more popular.
Yeah,
I had a friend who had internet, and every now and then I'd go to his house and use email, and that was sporadic. And I did have a friend, another colleague who was at my site, and she had a phone. I did not, so I would try to use the phone and talk to my parents every couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But the connection was not very good. It was a little
scratchy,
and it cut you off often. So we did a lot of communication by letter, old-fashioned letter.
How worried were your parents for you being over there?
I think they were worried. I know that they know that I have a good level head, and they weren't concerned that I was going to do anything too stupid. But I think that anyone would worry when your child is very far away from them and they have no control over the situation.
And when you got lonely and when things were kind of dark, what did you do? I mean, how did you cope with that?
Yeah, so I had a lot of books, and I read a lot. I think Peace Corps volunteers everywhere read a lot of books. That's cheap entertainment, and it's low-tech, too. So I did that. I exercised a lot as well. I tried to visit with friends. I was constantly going over to my local friend's house and my Peace Corps volunteer friend's house. Socializing helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to really sort of acclimate all together to being over there?
I think it took, well, definitely the first year. After first year, things got more comfortable. But really, I think by the time you're leaving Peace Corps, you're really more acclimated.
Is that a problem with the program?
No, I wouldn't say it's a problem. I think 2 years is a good amount of time mm-hmm. to be there.
How hard was it for you to leave when you did leave?
Oh, extremely hard. I had made so many friends, and I felt like I was embedded in the community.
But both natives and non-natives?
Exactly. Mostly, mm-hmm. yeah. I had only a few. There's two other Peace Corps volunteers in my town, and of course I had a lot of Peace Corps friends outside of where I lived. But I had a lot of local friends. I had a lot of community support there. And, of course, working at my school, I certainly missed being there. And I enjoyed what I was doing.
Joe, are you thinking you'd want to join the Peace Corps? Is that something that's completely outside your...
Yeah, I think that's that's probably outside of what I'd rather do.
Outside your comfort zone?
Yeah, I think so. That sounds very dedicated.
Yeah. Kirsty, what do the locals think of you leaving your American home to be with them over there?
Well, to be honest, I think they thought I was crazy.
Really?
Well, when I was there in the late 90s, there wasn't a lot of precedent for this type of American style of volunteering that we do. I mean, the Soviet Union that Kazakhstan was part of, they had their community groups, their civic groups, but they didn't have this kind of organic volunteering that we have. And they certainly didn't have a program like Peace Corps. And my town, Rudny, was experiencing a lot of economic problems, as was the rest of the country. It just had high unemployment. It was a terrible situation there. And they thought, well, why would you come here? of all places, why are you going to come here where we're all trying to leave?
And you said?
I said, why not? I mean, that's what I signed up for. When you sign up for the Peace Corps, you sign up to be flexible, to go anywhere where it's needed. And when I found out I was going to Kazakhstan, okay, I'm going.
You know, there's a cultural exchange thing going on here, too. And tell me about celebrating Thanksgiving over there, Kirstie, and what they thought of American stuffing and foods like that.
Yeah. So one thing my students really, really enjoyed was celebrating American holidays. They really got into that. They were excited about Halloween. They got dressed up as ghosts. They really got into the trick-or-treating tradition. Thanksgiving was another holiday I introduced to them. We got a big, long table put together in one of the classrooms, asked the cafeteria staff to cook up some chickens. My church donated a whole bunch of goods from home, such as pumpkin pie mix and, you know, all the other regular things that you have at Thanksgiving. We made some potatoes. We had yams. And they sent stuffing. So, of course, we made stuffing to have everyone share and experience that. And the students looked at it like, what is this green and brown stuff? It just didn't look appetizing to them at all. And the rest of the American volunteers that were there, we were like, okay, you don't like that? Pass it here. Yeah. We love stuffing. So it was definitely a cultural experience for them.
Well, Joe Flake, again, a volunteer firefighter in Paola, we were just hearing Kirstie say how difficult it was to be new in a foreign country. I'm guessing that being new as a firefighter is also difficult. There's an acclimation period that goes on there as well.
Yeah, there really is. You know, when you first come on, you really don't know anything about what we do. And there's training involved. There's a KU program called Firefighter 1, Firefighter 2. And all our guys on our department have passed through that.
People don't think firefighting is that complicated, though. Why do you need courses to learn how to shoot water at hot stuff? I mean, what's that about?
You know, a lot of it has to do with operating as a team. You know, there are ways to carry a ladder. There are ways to put a ladder up. There's ways to operate a hose so that you operate with somebody else. So there's a lot of things that are involved that have to do with teamwork.
Hmm. And safety must be a very big deal with all of this, too.
It is. And, you know, when I first got into the fire service back in the mid-80s, you know, safety was a lot different than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we look at that a lot differently. Back then, you know, you just had to be tough. You just had to, you know, gut it out. And nowadays, it's not like that. You know, we need to be safe. We need to cut down on accidents. We need to cut down on deaths. So, yeah, it's a lot different than it used to be 25, 30 years ago.
You know, how many fires a year do you end up responding to as a volunteer firefighter in Paola? And how many do you respond to as a paid firefighter with the Overland Park Fire Department?
Well, I might just correct you there. I'm actually not with the Overland Park Fire Department anymore. I retired from there.
Oh, really? Okay.
But, you know, in Paola, we'll run about 280 or 300 fire calls. And, of course, not all of those are working fires.
You get 280 calls a year?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot.
It really is. It's a fairly busy volunteer department. You know, if you go to smaller cities, they're going to run a lot less than that.
Yeah. What's it like to rescue somebody from a smashed up vehicle?
You know, that's a pretty rewarding thing. And that's one of the things that we really train on a lot. You know, with cars today, they're built a lot different than they were 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more electronics involved. Of course, there's all the airbags, which can really be dangerous if they have not gone off yet.
Oh, really?
You know, cars crumple differently than they did 30 years ago. So that's an ongoing kind of training that we do all the time because vehicles have changed a lot.
I've read just of some of your experiences, and maybe one key is to get somebody down in the car or close to the person who's trapped to sort of ease them through a situation like that.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we try to do whenever we can is get somebody in the vehicle and get them both covered up because there's still going to be some breaking glass and there's going to be some sharp edges and so forth. So, yeah, we try to get somebody in the vehicle with them whenever we can.
Do you still use, like, the Jaws of Life?
We do. We don't necessarily use that particular brand. Mm-hmm. You know, that's kind of like Coca-Cola, you know. But it's still what we call a spreaders or cutters. And there's several different companies that make those now. And they're a lot more portable. There's a lot lighter. But they're still very strong, and we use them all the time to extricate a patient.
And the best thing about being a volunteer firefighter is what?
You know, it's a pretty elite group of people. You know, if you look around the country at the number of people that are firefighters, it's still pretty small. But when you look at the number that volunteer, that's an even smaller group.
I want to bring Jim Mitchum into our conversation. He's the CEO of Heart to Heart International. And, Jim, so good to have you here, too.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, Heart to Heart is responding to the Ebola crisis in West Africa, and maybe not in the way we usually think of emergency work during an epidemic like this. What's happening there?
Well, first of all, there is a huge need. Mm-hmm. A number of groups are involved, and I think on the ground fighting Ebola itself, we find the International Medical Corps, a U.S. Organization, and also Doctors Without Borders. Both of those organizations have doctors on the scene working with local people as well, and they're on the front line. And so we have been supplying them with necessary medical equipment, pharmaceutical products, and other devices that they need to be safe. And keeping safe while you're treating a patient is absolutely critical. Approximately 10% of the confirmed cases of Ebola to date have been in medical workers.
Wow.
So it is a dangerous occupation, if you will.
So how do you convince people to volunteer for Heart to Heart when the stakes can be that grave, I guess?
Well, let's go on, because we are sending the advanced team from Heart to Heart this Sunday.
I was going to ask
you. They leave
Kansas
weekend. City International
yeah.
Airport, headed for Monrovia, Liberia.
How many people are going?
There are four people going. They will be on the ground to make all the arrangements, to network with our various agencies that we're already in contact with the government of Liberia, with the U.S. government, so that we have all of those arrangements in place and the logistics in place. Because once you put people on the ground, it's very important that they have a place to live. They have a place where the food and the water are safe. They have transportation. The hospital is ready for them, et cetera. So before we actually send the medical teams in, our advanced team goes and makes sure that all those arrangements are in place.
And are these folks volunteers or are they paid staff?
Both. So we have two volunteers, a doctor and a nurse, and we have two paid staff. And they will focus on different parts of those arrangements while they're on the ground. But once the medical teams start going in, they will be volunteers. So we have doctors and nurses from around this region, for the most part, who have experience. They have worked in third world environments with us in previous problems and crises. For example, many of them were in Haiti with us. They fought cholera outbreaks. They've been in the Philippines with us. They've been to Hurricane Sandy. You name it, they've been there. This is going to be a different level.
I was going to say, again, we're talking about extreme volunteering here, and this is a completely different level. Why are they doing it, given what you said about the stats and 10% of workers becoming infected here? Why are they doing it?
Steve, they do it because they're some of the greatest people you'll ever meet. They care about other people. They care that there are probably going to be 50 or more thousand people infected with Ebola. They care that half of those people and perhaps more will die from this outbreak, from what is now an out of control condition. We talk about the fires in California and how that is an out of control condition. This is a fire raging in West Africa, and it's out of control. Nobody knows how large it will be before it's stopped, and it will only be stopped when others join the fight.
You know, Kirsty, we're talking here about the health risk that some volunteers take. Certainly, the Peace Corps sends people all over the world in places where you can not only have epidemics, you can have violence, unrest that pops up from time to time. What happens, you know, if you're a volunteer in an area where violence flares, like the Ukraine, or where there's a serious disease is spreading? How does the Peace Corps handle that?
Yeah, so usually the Peace Corps is going to be very careful before they even send Peace Corps volunteers out to a country or choose a country. They assess the situation. They assess the risks. So they're not going to send someone to a country that they assess it as a high risk area.
But still, stuff can happen.
Still, yes, it's true. Stuff does happen. And a lot of the times, there'll be a situation that may just be localized to a certain area. And it's still okay to have Peace Corps volunteers in the country because usually they're serving out in the countryside. They're not in maybe the capital city, or they're not in the larger areas where that might happen. But if there is an outbreak of some kind of violence and it affects the entire country, they're definitely going to evacuate volunteers, and especially if there's an epidemic such as with the Ebola outbreak.
I was going to say, under what circumstances would the Peace Corps say, okay, the gig's up, Kirsten, you're coming home?
Yeah, it has to be an extreme circumstance, and where they really feel that this like with the Ebola outbreak, it's going to touch the lives of the volunteers, and it's going to make them unable. Well, it might put them at risk and make them unable to continue their service.
Jim Mitchum, again, he's the CEO of Heart to Heart International. I mean, when your volunteers enter into this area with an epidemic like Ebola present, how are they going to protect themselves? What do we know about that going into it?
Well, first of all, there is a lot of good information available, and we are working with the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, to provide the best and most effective training for everyone before they go over. But when they go over, they will also be accompanied from supplies that we have of what are called personal protection devices. And these are things such as gloves and gowns and masks and goggles and even total barrier suits that are available. We are not going, though, Steve, and this is the important part I need to make clear, we're not going to be on the front line of Ebola treatment. That is being handled, as I mentioned, by some other organizations. But it's what's important to note is that there are 4 million people in Liberia, and there's virtually no medical care at the moment for any of them. So if we can imagine Kansas City, twice the size of the metropolitan area of Kansas City, without a single hospital, doctor, nurse available for those people, that's what they're facing. So our docs and nurses are going over there to help take up the slack. They're going to treat the malaria patient, the HIV patient. They're going to take up the appendicitis problems when they show up. They're going to be working with mothers who are delivering babies. And those needs are just totally unmet today.
Well, I commend all of you for the good work you have done, you are doing. Again, that was the voice of Jim Mitchum. He's the CEO of Heart to Heart International. Earlier, we heard from Joe Flake, a volunteer firefighter for Paola, Kansas, and Kirstie Morgan, a former Peace Corps volunteer. Thank you all very much for your service, and thanks for coming in today. So good to have you all.
Thank you so much,
It's our pleasure.